Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're really getting into, well, a pretty dramatic story from history full of art, ambition, and ultimately loss.
We are. It's centered on Charles I of England. Now, most people know him for, well, losing his head in 1649.
Right.
But before all that, he pulled off something truly remarkable, culturally speaking. He set out to build just the most incredible art collection England had ever seen, aiming to rival, you know, Rome or Madrid.
An incredible ambition, but the flip side is just devastating. He gathers over 1,500 paintings, this amazing collection, and then within years of his execution, poof.
Gone. Completely liquidated, broken up, sold off piece by piece. It actually became the biggest art sale in history.
And the aim was what? To erase the symbols of monarchy? Turn grandeur into cash?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The great irony, the completely unintended consequence, is that this massive sell-off basically kickstarted the modern art market as we know it.
Okay, so that's our mission for this deep dive then, to follow this whole arc.
Exactly. Well, look at how collecting even got started in England, how Charles actually built this collection, this Whitehall group people talk about. Then there's the Van Dyck era, all that glamour.
Ah, yes, the image making.
And finally, the chaos of the sale itself. The Commonwealth sale and what happened next. The fallout.
All right, let's start at the beginning then, the foundations. Because as you said, England wasn't exactly the center of the art collecting world initially.
No, not at all. You have to understand, the whole idea of collecting art just for its beauty or status, that really started much earlier in Renaissance Italy, late 1400s.
Like the Medici.
Exactly. The Medici, the Farnese. They built these huge galleries. It was about splendor and magnificence,
yeah.
You know, showing off political clout, spiritual authority through culture.
Okay, and then it moves north.
Sort of, yeah. In Northern Europe around the 1500s, you get the rise of the Wunderkammer, the Cabinet of Curiosities.
Oh, it is eclectic collections.
Yeah, much more varied. You'd find natural history specimens, weird rocks, maybe some relics, alongside, yes, some paintings and sculptures. Emperor Rudolf II in Prague, he was the prime example of that.
But paintings themselves, they weren't always the top ticket item. That seems strange to us now.
It does, but it's true. Back in the 1600s, if you look at the valuations, paintings often played second fiddle to things like elaborate tapestries, gold and silver plate, and especially jewels.
Jewels were king.
Absolutely. Jewels were the real signifiers of wealth and status. There's a great example. Cardinal Mazarin in France, a huge collector.
Mm-hmm.
His jewels and goldsmith work, valued at over 400,000 French livres. Massive amount. His paintings, and he had a lot of great ones, only about half that, maybe 224,000 livres.
Wow. So the English court was thinking along those lines, too.
Initially, yes. England kind of enters the art game a bit late. We usually credit Anne of Denmark, James I's wife, with getting the royal collection started. Charles inherited that.
But the real shift towards appreciating art for art's sake, the connoisseurship, that yeah. comes from someone else.
Right. That really starts with Thomas Howard, the Earl of Arundel. He's often called the father of collecting in England. He traveled a lot, especially to Italy, buying up classical statues, paintings.
Mm.
He had the eye, the intellectual approach.
Okay, so Arundel lays the groundwork. But Charles I brings the royal firepower, the money.
He brings the money and the intense personal drive. And here's a key moment, a real turning point for Charles. It happens during a diplomatic trip to Spain in 1623.
The one to woo the Spanish Infanta, which was a total political disaster, wasn't it?
Complete failure on the marriage front, yes.
Yeah.
He went hoping to marry Philip IV's sister, Maria Anna, came back without a bride, feeling pretty humiliated.
So how did that failed trip change his taste in art?
Well, while he was there, for months, he was just completely immersed in the Spanish court. And culturally, it was light years ahead of England. He saw Philip IV's collection stunning, over 2,000 paintings.
2,000.
It made him realize his own inherited collection back home was, frankly, a bit old-fashioned, a bit provincial. He came back with this totally new perspective. Suddenly, it was about the artist, the technique, the composition. Not just who or what was depicted. He wanted masterpieces.
And that new perspective came with a price tag, which leads us to the big one, right? The Gonzaga purchase.
The big one indeed, 1627. He manages to buy the bulk of the collection of the Dukes of Mantua in Italy. We're talking around 400 paintings.
400 paintings for how much?
18,000 pounds. 18,000 pounds. Now, you have to understand, in 1627, that was an absolutely colossal amount of money.
Like, what could that buy otherwise?
Oh, you could fund a decent chunk of a military campaign or keep the entire royal household going for months. It was a huge gamble.
But it paid off, reputationally.
Instantly. Overnight, Charles I wasn't just the King of England. He was a major player on the European cultural stage. He had a world-class collection.
And it wasn't just quantity, right? There were some serious heavy hitters in there.
Absolutely top-tier stuff. Masterpieces by Titian, Correggio. Plus iconic Renaissance works like Raphael's cartoons, these huge designs for tapestries, and Mantegna's incredible series, The Triumph of Caesar.
Mantegna's Triumph. Wasn't that incredibly expensive on its own?
It was. That alone cost £10,000, bought a bit later in 1631. Charles really zeroed in on the Italian High Renaissance. He adored Titian, loved that mix of sensuousness and elegance.
Interesting.
Thought Titian would never look dated. But interestingly, he wasn't so keen on some others. Didn't much care for Veronese, apparently. And he completely missed the boat on contemporary giants like Rembrandt or Caravaggio. Never bought them.
Selective taste. And he gathered this circle around him, the Whitehall Group. What was that exactly? A formal club?
Not formal, no. More like an influential clique of collectors all orbiting the king, sharing his passion. You had Charles himself with over 1,500 paintings by the end.
1,500.
Then Arnold, the connoisseur, with maybe 650. James Hamilton, Duke of Hamilton, amassed 600 incredibly quickly. And George Villiers, the Duke of Buckingham.
Buckingham. He sounds like he was maybe less discriminating, more aggressive.
Definitely more impetuous, less the scholar like Arundel, more about snapping things up fast. He used agents like Balthazar Gerbier very effectively to acquire works like Titian's Ecce Homo.
But his collecting career was cut short.
Yeah, he was assassinated in 1628, but the core group, driven by Charles, just kept acquiring at this incredible pace.
So Charles has the old masters, the Italian Renaissance is sorted, but he needs someone to craft the image of his monarchy, right? That projection of power and divine right.
Exactly. And that's where the ultimate recruitment coup happens, getting Anthony van Dyck to London.
The image maker arrives.
Big time. Van Dyck comes over in 1632. Charles knights him almost immediately, makes him principal painter in ordinary to their majesties. This wasn't just hiring a painter, it was like signing a superstar.
Putting him on par with Titian or Rubens in terms of court status?
Precisely. Van Dyck's presence screamed that the English court was now a top-tier European cultural hub.
And his impact on how royalty looked, it was massive, wasn't it? He basically invented their public image. I love that story about Sophia of Hanover meeting the queen.
Oh, it's brilliant. Sophia, who later became Electress of Hanover, had only seen Van Dyck's portraits of Queen Henrietta Maria. She wrote about being totally shocked when she met her in person.
What did she say?
She said Van Dyck gave this wonderful impression of beauty, but the real queen was a small woman with long, skinny arms and teeth-like defense works projecting from her mouth.
Ouch. Teeth-like defense works. That's brutal.
It really shows you the power of the artist, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Van Dyck wasn't just recording likeness. He was crafting allure, projecting majesty. It became part of the political theater.
And he knew his worth. His prices went up.
Immediately. He basically doubled his rate for a full-length portrait from 25 to 50 pounds. He was the visual brand manager for the Stuart monarchy.
But his work wasn't just surface gloss, was it? Some portraits seem to have real psychological depth. Thinking of that Pembroke family portrait.
Philip Herbert. 4th Earl of Pembroke, with his family. Yes, exactly. Mm. On the surface, it's all silks and status. But it was painted around a forced marriage.
Ah.
And Van Dyck somehow captures this undercurrent of, well, anxiety, fragility, maybe even grief. It's not just a celebration. There's a subtle, sad story being told beneath the glitter. A still dance, as one description puts it.
And then the ultimate flex, maybe? Charles I in three positions?
The triple portrait from 1635-36.
Yes, what was the deal with that? Why paint him three times on one canvas?
It was purely functional, believe it or not,
yeah.
But also a massive status symbol. It was painted specifically to be sent to Rome.
To Rome? Why?
So that the greatest sculptor of the age, Gianlorenzo Bernini, could carve a marble bust of Charles without the king having to sit for him.
Wow. So it's like sending a 3D blueprint made of paint.
Exactly. Think of the statement that makes. We're commissioning the top guy in Rome, Bernini himself, and here's the high art reference package. It shouts sophistication, cultural connection, money.
All that effort, all that cultural capital, and then it all comes crashing down. The Civil War, the execution in 1649.
Right in front of the banqueting house at Whitehall, ironically. The very building designed to showcase his magnificence, filled with his treasures like the Mantegna Triumph. A bitter end.
So Charles is gone. Parliament needs money. Which brings us to the great liquidation, the Commonwealth sale.
Yeah. The act for the sale of the late king's goods is drawn up. The goal is blunt. raise cash for the Navy, pay off the Crown's huge debts. Simple as that.
They inventoried the paintings at a Riffin? What was it?
Around 33,690 pounds of the paintings alone. The idea was literally, as the documents say, to reduce the magnificence of monarchy to a simple cash value. Dismantle the aura.
But it didn't go smoothly at first.
Not at all. Total disaster initially. There was a recession hitting. The logistics were awful stuff, getting damaged, moving it. Everything poorly displayed at Somerset House. Nobody was buying.
So Parliament's stuck with all this art and still needs to pay its bills. What did they do?
They resorted to something quite extraordinary. Paying creditors in kind.
Wait, you mean instead of cash, they gave people paintings? Plumbers got Titians?
Pretty much. If Parliament owed you money, maybe you were the king's tailor or a supplier, they'd settle the debt by giving you a chunk of the king's former property, including art.
That's incredible. What were these creditors supposed to do with a Dürer portrait?
Exactly. Most didn't want the art. They wanted money. So they were forced to team up, form these groups called syndicates or dividends, basically little consortiums, to try and sell this stuff on the open market and get their cash back.
Okay, I can see where this is going. This must have created a crazy situation for buyers.
Oh, a speculator's dream. Suddenly, masterpieces are in the hands of people desperate to sell quickly. Market inefficiency doesn't even begin to cover it.
Who jumped in first?
The Spanish ambassador, Alonso de Cardenas. He was buying secretly for King Philip IV back in Spain. He snapped up amazing deals, like two Dürer portraits bought from the king's tailor for just 75 pounds each.
75 pounds for a Dürer. Unbelievable.
Pennies on the pound. And it wasn't just foreign agents. Domestic figures got involved, too. Colonel John Hutchinson, ironically one of the judges who condemned Charles.
What did he do?
He turned into quite the art speculator. Bought Titian's Venus with organ player for 165 pounds, flipped it almost right away to an agent for Archduke Leopold Wilhelm of Austria for 600 pounds.
Peace, profit.
But that was nothing. His real coup was Titian's Pardo Venus. He picked that up for 600 pounds. Held onto it for a bit, then sold it later for 4,900 pounds.
4,900 from 600. That's almost an eightfold return.
Astonishing. Yeah. It just shows how rock bottom the prices were in that initial scramble before the big international players really understood what was available.
When did the prices start to climb properly?
Around 1652-53. That's when the French agents, buying through Cardinal Mazarin, really entered the fray. Suddenly you had serious competition.
A bidding war.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a famous case where the French agent, Bordeaux, had to pay a whopping 3,000 pounds for Correggio's Venus and Cupid with a satyr, primarily just to stop the Spanish ambassador Cardenillos from getting it. The gloves were off.
Amidst all the selling, did Cromwell's government keep anything?
They did hold back a few key items.
Yeah.
Most famously, Mantegna's Triumph of Caesar and Raphael's cartoons. They stayed at Hampton Court.
Why those specifically?
Well, partly the subject matter non-royal, non-Catholic, but probably more practically, they were just so huge, so famous, so iconic. They were almost too big and too well-known to sell off discreetly. Seen perhaps as national treasures, even by the Republic.
Okay, fast forward. 1660, the monarchy is back. Charles II is on the throne. His father's amazing collection is scattered across Europe. What does he do?
He tries pretty desperately to get it back. Sets up this system, offering a 20% reward to anyone who could discover and recover former royal property.
Sounds like that could get messy.
Oh, it did. Led to abuses. You know, agents running around seizing paintings, sometimes just copies, hoping for a payout. One agent, a guy named Hawley, reportedly grabbed over 600 paintings. Chaos.
But some things were recovered, sometimes in amazing ways, like that statue.
Ah, yes. Hubert Le Sueur's bronze equestrian statue of Charles I. Fantastic story. It was sold off during the Commonwealth to a metalsmith.
Who is supposed to melt it down?
Exactly. Parliament ordered it destroyed. But this metalsmith, John Rivet, he supposedly buried it in his garden in Covent Garden. Hid it all through the interregnum.
No way.
Yes. Dug it up after the Restoration. And eventually in 1675, it was put up where it still stands today, near Charing Cross, looking right down Whitehall towards where Charles was executed. A real symbol of survival.
An incredible symbol. But ultimately, most of the truly great paintings, they stayed gone.
Sadly, yes. The cream of the collection. There's still highlights in the Louvre, the Prado in Madrid, the Kunsthistorisches in Vienna. Charles II never got most of them back.
Did other countries help return things?
Not really systemically. The Dutch government gave Charles II three Titians as a diplomatic gift upon his restoration, but it wasn't like a formal restitution program. The damage was done.
So let's pull back this whole saga. King collects, king is executed, collection is sold off in chaos. What's the big takeaway, the lasting impact?
Well, the stated goal was to destroy the magnificence of monarchy, turn it into mere cash. But the completely unintended consequence was profound.
Which was?
By treating these royal masterpieces essentially as commodities, as liquid assets, and scattering them across Europe to ambassadors, speculators, even tradesmen. The Commonwealth sale fundamentally changed how art was bought and sold. It really marks the birth of the first proper secular art market in England, and arguably influenced Europe, too.
The system we basically have today, with dealers, auctions, price lists.
It laid the groundwork. It accelerated that shift towards valuing the artist's name and skill connoisseurship over the subject matter. It forced the creation of price comparisons, public sales. It detached the value of the art, in a way, from the crown that once owned it.
So Charles I collected art to bolster the idea of divine monarchy, using art as a tool of state power.
Exactly.
But the destruction of that collection, meant to dismantle his legacy, ironically ended up creating the foundation for the modern, more commercial, more secular art world we live in.
Precisely. A complete historical paradox. The attempt to erase magnificence inadvertently created a whole new system for valuing it.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? What other historical moments, maybe tragedies or upheavals intended to destroy something old, have ended up accidentally building something entirely new and lasting in culture? Something for you, the listener, to ponder.